Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, High Noon and Papal Splendour in episode 27 of the Vatican Centuries. How Raphael drew his inspiration from Nero's golden home. That's with our popular Latin lover. And why the Roman branch of the followers of Mary Ward recently took the name of Congregation of Jesus. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. It's time for episode 27 of the Vatican Centuries. While last week we got a taste of light and shadow as the first of the Renaissance popes, Sixtus IV, built the Sistine Chapel, leaving his mark on Rome, while a fanatic friar by the name of Savonarola is executed, today we move on to more papal splendour as Botticelli paints the Sistine Chapel, as Alexander VI has the ceiling of the Basilica of St. Mary Major gilded with plundered gold. But do stay tuned and listen to this programme, written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The Renaissance was nearing its peak. As scholarship and humanism continued to thrive, the complete man reigned supreme. And in this ideal climate, artistic genius reached a perfection never known before or since.
The age of discovery had barely begun. In 1496, John Cabot became the first European to cross the Atlantic by the route of the ancient Vikings.
At the turn of the century, Amerigo Vespucci realized that Columbus had discovered a continent, and the German cartographer Walzer Müller declared that the new world should be named America because Amerigo had discovered it.
In architecture, the ornate pointed arch and soaring Gothic spire had long given way to the simplicity of the classical style.
Houses were no longer fortresses. With larger rooms and windows, the interiors were full of light and colour.
Fireplaces were not only used for cooking, but for heating the houses.
People's table manners were improving. Forks were being used instead of fingers.
Buttons and spectacles were now common.
Simple piety received a new impulse by the Dominican popularisation of the rosary.
And on the walls of many churches, the Stations of the Cross could now be seen.
Rome, at the start of the 16th century, presented a contrasting picture. The splendours of the papal court were offset by the squalor of the city's back streets. Assassins lurking in the shadows rubbed shoulders with brethren of the religious confraternities who provided pensions for widows and dowries for orphaned girls.
Condemned men on their way to the scaffold were accompanied by members of the Misericordia in black robes and hoods and were buried to the chant of solemn prayers.
In many parts of the city, cattle were pastured, and to foreigners, the Romans themselves looked like cowherds, dressed as they were in peasants' cloaks and boots. For them, social gatherings were limited to meetings at church, where they could admire the fine ladies. And at carnival time, when the popes offered them entertainment, magnificent processions celebrating the triumphs of the Roman emperors of old.
But the Romans were only spectators. They took no more part in the events of their time than the pilgrims and other visitors, who are now a permanent feature of the life of the Eternal City. And life there was, in great variety. Rome was distinguished by the elaborate ceremonial of the papal court, partly Byzantine in origin. Rome was the chief school of diplomatic etiquette, a clearinghouse for news, and a vital link in the chain of European politics.
The popes, like other European rulers, were committed to building up a well-financed, efficient, and firmly controlled state. But their office was elective. Unlike other temporal princes, the Pope could not pass on his title to a member of his family. Nor did any Pope ever presume to do so, even when the moral tone of the papacy was at its lowest ebb.
Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope, perhaps painted blacker than he actually was, reigned from 1492 to 1503. In Rome, he was told, there had been more than 220 murders in the 3 months between the onset of his predecessor's illness and his own coronation. This was such a grand affair that Alexander fainted twice during the ceremony.
Alexander's time saw the erection of the famous Tempietto by Bramante, later to have a great influence on Roman architecture. Alexander added a fountain to St. Peter's, called in Pinturicchio to paint the Borgia apartments, and, tradition says, gilded the ceiling of St. Mary Major with the first of the plunder to arrive from the Americas.
Alexander's pontificate was stormy. In 1494, he was obliged to receive Charles VIII of France into Rome. A year later, the Tiber overflowed. Water ran 10 feet deep in the streets and people had to go about in boats. Lightning struck Castel Sant'Angelo, and the gunpowder stored there exploded and destroyed the upper part of the fortress.
A known libertine who openly acknowledged his numerous illegitimate children, Alexander had to face the scathing criticism of the Dominican friar Savonarola, whom he excommunicated and later had executed.
On the evening of November the 2nd, 1499, two men were talking together, Doffo Spini and Sandro Botticelli. Spini was one of the men who had examined Savonarola, sent to his death the previous year. Botticelli had been one of the friar's devoted followers and had given up painting nudes when the Dominican denounced such works. Savonarola had confessed under torture to all kinds of enormities, including fraud and deception. Botticelli suffered deeply from this confession and his hero's subsequent trial and death, and tried desperately to understand the meaning of the tragedy.
According to Doffo Spini, Savonarola's inquisitors had found no sin in him, and the friar had been sentenced to death to appease the Florentine mob.
After Savonarola's execution, Botticelli undertook no more important commissions, and prematurely old, hobbled about Florence on sticks. He had no money, and his powers were failing.
Posterity remembers him very differently. Born in Florence in 1444, youngest of a tanner's 7 children, Botticelli was apprenticed to a goldsmith and later to Fra Filippo Lippi, the painter. He became famous in his lifetime, but although he earned well, he spent freely and was often hard up.
Of a deeply religious turn of mind, Botticelli achieved his first success with a painting called The Adoration of the Magi. It was after this that Sixtus IV summoned him to Rome to take charge of the decoration of the Sistine Chapel.
Back in Florence, Botticelli came into contact with Lorenzo de' Medici's circle and turned to classical subjects. Two of these, The Birth of Venus and The Primavera, are perhaps his greatest loved paintings.
Sandro Botticelli believed that love purified could lead men to truth, and his Birth of Venus illustrated the ideal of Florentine civilization, the setting of what was best in the classical world within a Christian framework.
The art of Botticelli was one with his personality, typical of the early Renaissance, with its hope and belief in the human spirit. It was to give way later to the more sombre, battling art of Michelangelo.
And warm thanks there go to Gilbert Villacqua for this 27th episode of The Vatican Centuries, a series she's written and presented, and also to Sean Patrick Lovett for the production work. You can hear the next in this series at this very same time next week. And speaking of Raphael, I'd now like to bring you a light interlude connected precisely to this artist as we join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. I'm going to play a little game with Father Reginald Foster.
This is a game.
Yeah, I'd like to go to some of the places of particular interest in this city, beginning with the Domus Aurea. That's somebody's house.
The golden house of Nero, because he had it gilded with gold.
It's actually written Aurea, isn't that right?
It's golden.
Golden.
Because aurum is gold.
But it doesn't mean breeze in Latin, aura?
No, aura. I always tell my students, one letter will kill you. Aurea is golden. Aura is breeze. This is the golden, the gilded house of Nero.
What did he get up to in there?
Well, he built that whole area of the whole city was his house, which is now underground. And he had this gilded and so forth and so on. It's very, very important.
Was gold very precious in those days?
Still, yeah, it was and still is. Yeah. And he decided to do the ceilings. This has all been lost, of course. But you might be interested to know, now that you mentioned the thing, Raffaello got into that Domus Aurea when he was 14 years old and saw the paintings of Nero's house. And he perpetuated these paintings until he died when he was 37, 30 years later. So,
and he said it was beautiful.
Well, I mean, we have paintings up in the Vatican near my office up there, which are replicas of what Raphael found in the Domus Aurea. And there's another thing that your listeners don't know, because some of these, I know we're taking off time, but some of these figures like gargoyles, like masks, you know, from the theater and stuff, strange faces, we say are grotesque in English, you know, because they look kind of ugly or distorted.
In the minds of the artists, they're meant to.
No, they're not. No, no. And the fact is what they're called in Italian is pittura grotesca, which are grotto paintings. And they're called grotto paintings because the house of Nero is under the ground. And when Raffaello got into the house of Nero, they were going through the park up on top into this house which was buried. And so the paintings they found were paintings found in grottos under the ground. That's where you get grotesque from, which no one knows.
Nero's golden house in his day was above the ground.
In his day? No, go on, next question.
The next question refers to gold again. There's this expression in English which says, all that glitters is not gold. Well, this isn't the case, because this did glitter, well, and it was kind of
expression.
Golden.
There's a Latin.
How does one translate that?
Non sunt aurea quae fulgent omnia. This is Publilius Syrus, who was a man on the stage in Caesar's time and had these one-line phrases which have come also into English. And he says, omnia quae fulgent non sunt aurea. All things which shine are not gold. This is from Caesar's time.
So I was going to play a little game, but you actually played
the game.
Well,
no, play the game. Play the game. Go on.
I was going to take you to Hadrian's Villa, but we can do that some other time. Nero was a strange character, wasn't he? But he was obviously very wealthy. Did he care about money? Did he suffer from avarice?
The wealthy thing, the fact is he was his problem, as Caligula's problem was, he was a genius. And he was precocious. And he was a child genius. And most of these people, even today, got it, who are genii, you know, IQs, intelligent quotients, you know, most of them burn out by the time they're 40. So the fact is he was, and when he was in his teens, he spoke in Greek and Latin. He was a gladiator. He was a painter. He was a musician. He was everything. That was his problem. He was too smart for his age.
So he burnt out and he burned down.
He burnt out. And the fact is he became emperor. And he was 21 when he became emperor, you see. 54 to 68. Okay. Okay, 14 years. So by the time he was 35, he was finished. And he became kind of like went crazy. He was too smart. He was precocious. He was a child genius. That's what he was. He wasn't crazy from the beginning. He kind of became that way. And so wealthy and stuff, of course, wealthy, he had the whole world.
And heartfelt thanks there to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. Finally, as you know, on Monday, February the 1st, Pope Benedict confirmed his forthcoming apostolic visit to Great Britain during an encounter with the bishops of England and Wales in Rome on their ad limina visit. England is a part of the world I'd now like to take you to by shining the spotlight once again on an inspiring English lady born in 1585 into a staunchly Catholic Yorkshire family at a time when society could not envisage the peaceful coexistence of Catholics and Protestants. You may have guessed her name is Mary Ward, and as you may have noted as well, the Holy Father recently recognized her heroic virtues, placing her on the path to sainthood. And so it's time now for the second part in my series, marking the 400th anniversary of the founding vision of Mary Ward. So do stay tuned, as in a few moments we no longer look at her story, which you can find on our website at www.vaticanradio.org, but at the reasons behind a choice of a name for one branch of her followers, the Rome branch. It's Congregation of Jesus, or Congregatio Jesu, a title which may have brought to mind the Society of Jesus. And if you tuned in to part one of this series, you recall how we learned how Mary Ward in 1611 wrote that she'd heard distinctly, not in sound of voice, but in intellectual understanding, the words "take the same as the society." Stay tuned. This story begins at the time of the Second Vatican Council, when religious congregations were encouraged, in an effort to go forward, to look back at the original charism of their founders.
Mary Ward's charism was so clearly Ignatian. We set up various commissions to study what it meant to have the full constitutions of the Jesuits and whether, in fact, the Jesuits and the Church would ever allow, after 400 years, a women's congregation to take these constitutions.
Mr. Francis Orchard, Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, sat down with me here in our studios and explained how the Jesuit constitutions Mary Ward had called for 4 centuries ago were finally adopted in 2003, not without much soul-searching and not without the permission of the Church and the Society of Jesus. Constitutions adopted almost in their entirety. That's if you exclude anything relating to priesthood. But the question that comes to mind is, why did the followers of Mary Ward have these constitutions so much at heart after all these centuries?
Ignatius of Loyola, when he called his congregation the Jesuits, saw the entire concept as being in the following of Jesus. And Mary Ward also wanted them also to have the name of Jesus in their title. Because she never persuaded the Jesuits to let that happen, and the Church in the end suppressed her, she never gave her congregation a name.
Mary Ward may not have given her congregation a name, but plenty of others did, nicknaming her and her followers Jesuitesses or Galloping Girls in a deliberate, derogatory manner. That's during her lifetime. Subsequently, as the congregation survived and developed, it took on a very obvious name, natural at least in Germany and Italy, that of the English Ladies. It was only in the 18th century that the order actually took a specific name, that of the Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary, a title accepted by the two branches of this order, the Roman one we spoke of earlier, now called the Congregation of Jesus, and that other Irish Loreto one that never changed that name. Convinced a diverging approach to their names must have created an issue, I asked Sister Frances if, in 2003, their change of name had provoked mixed feelings.
Yes, I think feelings were enormously mixed between those who had been working hard for this, who were absolutely overjoyed and enthusiastic, to those who felt a little bit that, you know, we've got very used to the title Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary. It looks as if we're moving away from Mary. There was a feeling, of course, that both branches had had the same title. Now one branch would retain the title, the other would adopt Congregatio Jesu. You know, was that a consideration? But in fact, I find in practice, I am pleased that we have the name Jesus because it's what Mary Ward wanted.
Was there any reaction on the part of the Jesuits?
No, not at all, because they had been kept informed of our intentions right from the start. The Jesuits are aware of the history of their relationship with the congregation, which has not always been smooth. Even at the time of Mary Ward, there were some Jesuits who supported her wholeheartedly, including initially Father John Gerard, a seminary priest in England, the only person ever to have escaped from the Tower of London. Later on, when his provincial ordered him out of England after the gunpowder plot and he moved to the continent, he became Mary Ward's confessor. And it was probably through him that she got hold of her copy of the Jesuit constitutions.
It was difficult to get hold of the Jesuit constitutions.
It was difficult to get hold of.
I mean, they weren't. Not like today.
You
go to the bookshop
again. That's right. No. That didn't work like that. Not all Jesuits had their own copy. But Mary Ward certainly had a copy because she copied large chunks of it by hand. Because she needed to know and understand what it was that she felt God was calling her to take on.
All very well, I thought to myself. That's the history of it all, but what about the followers of Mary Ward today? Where do they put her charism into practice? And how? I knew that, like the Jesuits, they were keen on education. So I put the question to Sister Frances once again, who remarked that this was possibly because education was one of the few areas that the Church once allowed women to be involved in. But she added, since Vatican II, her order began working in different continents and became involved in all areas where their presence, they felt, was most needed. Areas such as healthcare, social work, spiritual direction, and indeed in the media. Remarks which prompted a question. Does this mean that since Vatican II, you've had a different type of formation?
Yes, I think it does. It has followed the Ignatian concept of formation much more. If you're forming people to go out into tough mission areas, you have to form them to be people who can not only have a deep personal devotion to God, who are prepared to face hardships and difficulties, who are prepared to take initiatives, to adapt according to local circumstances as the need may be. In the Jesuit constitutions, it makes it very clear that the training in obedience is absolute. But once the member gets out to the mission, he's going to make his own decision as to what actually is required, because his local superior may be a very long way away and out of communication. So that you are forming people interiorly so that they can be people of discernment. Discernment to us is a very, very important concept, that you learn interiorly to listen to the movement of the Spirit as to what you are being called to do. And then you would normally discuss this with your superior. But if you're out on the mission field and you've got to make a decision on your own, you make that decision. Now, we wouldn't, of course, even today have sisters out in tough areas on their own.
You work in areas like, for example, STEM springs to mind, like Zimbabwe.
Yes, Zimbabwe particularly. We're very involved in the moment, particularly with our clinics trying to provide medical services to you know, very poor rural villages.
Under difficult circumstances. Under
extremely difficult circumstances. Or we'd be working with tribals in North India, or working now in Mongolia.
What are you doing in Mongolia?
Well, we're working under the bishop, providing basic catechesis, because there are not many Christians in that part of the world. Now we have sisters in Siberia, we have them in the Ukraine, we have them in Cuba.
So right across the world?
Right across the world. Wherever the church has expressed a particular need and we have felt able to respond to it. So that, you know, it isn't we're always in this place, always in that place, always in schools. There is now much more diversity.
Have you ever felt in your life that you were in the wrong order, that you'd chosen to join the wrong order?
No, I've never felt that. But I have watched with interest the development of the congregation, because when I entered many years ago, I entered the congregation in a very well-established house in a very well-established province. But I was young enough not to know really the difference between a semi-enclosed congregation and an apostolically active congregation. And looking back on it, I can see it was probably pretty semi-enclosed, because all congregations were before the Vatican Council. You had just sort of gradually had to compromise to get the recognition from the church. Well, in all our provinces, we reviewed what our ministries were, what our formation was. And because we were often in education, it was felt, no, the work in education, because you're forming people who are going to be of influence elsewhere in life of the church and in society, that is still a good work to be involved in. In other places, we may have decided that we weren't going to have the sisters to continue to keep some of these better-known educational establishments going, and therefore we had to begin the process of gradual transition to lay leadership. But that has gone on the whole very well. And that has released sisters for other work, to retrain for social work or go into spiritual ministries.
Is Mary Ward still the greatest inspiration to you?
Without doubt. She's become increasingly an inspiration.
What do you like most about her?
I love her warmth and humanity. I love her total single-minded adherence to what she was convinced God was calling her. And I love her lack of bitterness. She had no bitterness against the authorities at all. When her congregation was suppressed, and when she really understood it had been suppressed and it was not just a rumour, she accepted it as the will of God. And she encouraged her sisters to pray for our enemies. She's a real reconciler.
Our thanks there to Sister Frances Orchard, Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus. And that brings us up to time once again. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. So do join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.